welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only show that talks about watching soccer on TV, online, and on apps. Coming up on episode 9 of the World Soccer Talk podcast, we discuss the impact that a 48-team World Cup will have on television, news regarding developments at Fox Sports, as well as the new face of their Bundesliga coverage, details about the most watched Premier League game of the season thus far, and questions from you, the listeners. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
Not too bad, not too shabby. Kind of get into grips with the winter break. Well, it's not really a winter break in the Premier League, but enjoying this run of football, especially with the League Cup games this week and everything. So we'll be talking about that in a little bit. Okay, so let's go into segment one, which is what we've been watching, Kartik. Ooh. All right, so Kartik, let me kick off in terms of what I've been watching. This is kind of, I think, last Thursday it was. So it was after the podcast taped, but watched a really entertaining Copa del Rey first leg match between Athletic Bilbao and Barcelona. And for anyone who watched this match, I think you'd agree with me that it was a very physical game, but it was a game that the referee missed so much. It was a lot of things going on, a lot of fouls that the referee seemed to miss. So as the game progressed, it just got more physical and more physical. It ended up being that I think Athletic finished with 9 men on the field, but it could have easily been Barcelona could have had some players sent off too, and there was penalty kind of controversy also. The one thing that stood out for me for this match, unfortunately, was a really, and this is something, Kartik, I don't know if you've seen, but this is, whether this game or any other games, but it was an example of how well the mics are set up in a game. And it was unfortunate because there was an incident in the box, and Umtiti, the Barcelona defender, I think it was for a corner kick, was getting ready, standing in the box, and all of a sudden one of the Athletic players came over and elbowed him, or punched him, actually. It was more of a punch in his throat. And the Barcelona player fell to the ground, and the audio mics were able to pick up the sound of him. Basically, he couldn't breathe. I mean, and it seemed like a minute or 2 minutes, the medical crews rushed over, and he couldn't breathe. And it was one of those things that, it was like horrible to listen to, because the mics picked it up so well that you could hear everything, and you could see that the player was in distress. It was a blatant foul, and actually the referee missed it. There was no yellow card or red card. It should have been a red card, straight a red card for that incident. But I'm wondering if you've kind of seen anything like that before too, Carter, because it was pretty distressing for the viewer to watch.
It was really bad. It was really distressing, and I'm sure I have, but I just can't think offhand of anything quite like that I've seen recently.
Yeah. It's a good example of, I mean, the audio mics being able to pick up stuff, but in that instance, it was something that, oh gosh, I wish they had turned it down, because it was really painful to watch and listen to. And fortunately, he was fine. He got up, but then tried to retaliate, which I don't blame him, against the Athletic player. And it was a really physical game, but it was entertaining to watch from the football perspective also. FA Cup, I didn't watch every match, but I did watch quite a few. And the reason I didn't watch every match is my daughter had a soccer tournament. They won, fantastic, but it meant that I had to kind of watch FA Cup matches, either a little bit here, a little bit there, and some on delay, but I wasn't able to watch everything. But what I would say, Kartik, is that from my perspective, is Fox Sports' coverage was actually really good. In previous seasons, even last year and years before, there's always been some flubs, like whether it was on the maps, and I can't even remember which team it was, but they had a kind of a graphic showing kind of Great Britain, and they showed one of the teams completely.
I think it was Everton and West Ham game. I think they had London.
They had Everton in London or something like that? Right.
Yeah, something.
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of screw ups and stuff like that, or things that they would say, or just really kind of cringing kind of type of commentary or analysis. But this was really good. I think part of the reason really Kartik is the difference was, for me at least, was having Ian Joy front the broadcast rather than Rob Stone. For me, when Rob Stone's doing it, he seems a little bit insincere, doesn't really maybe value the FA Cup as much. Ian Joy, who's somebody who's probably played in it, he's played for Kidderminster in England as well as many teams throughout the Great British Isles as well as in Germany and the United States. But he seemed more authentic, really seemed to be kind of into it, and that seemed to help too. But yeah, so I enjoyed it. I mean, it was interesting too, actually, from the commentary perspective, because for that first match, the Man United against Reading, well, the first match on the Saturday, they began the broadcast with Ian Dark and Owen Hargreaves, and we've talked a lot about Ian Dark and Owen Hargreaves a couple episodes ago as far as some of our favorite commentators and co-commentators, and they were on the BT Sport feed. But within about 5 minutes after the match started, Fox switched it, and they switched it to the global feed. I guess they realized they made a mistake, and then I think we had Guy Mowbray for the rest of the match, which he's pretty good, but to me he's no Ian Dark or Owen Hargreaves. How about you, Kartik? Did you get a chance to watch much FA Cup?
No, quite frankly, coming off the festive period, and I was like a Premier League manager who rotates their squad. You know, coming off that festive period, I kind of rotated my viewing and spent not much time watching football this weekend. I did watch the Villarreal-Barca game, which I think was a disappointing result for Villarreal, given how well they played, given, again, some officiating controversies. I did watch that. I watched part of the Preston-Arsenal game, which I thought Preston outplayed them, the portion. So I watched but came back, saw that Arsenal came back and won. Giroud, no surprise, with a late goal. That's a specialty of his, like Solskjaer back in the day with Manchester United. And then tried to watch the Aston Villa Spurs game, but then our former colleague Nipun Chopra called me and said, hey, let's record a podcast on this Division II in the U.S., NASL, USL sanctioning. So I ended up doing that while I had the game on the television. You can find it on Nipun's stream somewhere. So, really, soccer-wise, my time was taken up by that whole D2 situation, which I know we'll get to later in the show.
Sure. Yeah, when duty calls, you got to kind of do the pod, so completely understandable there. Some of the other FA Cup stuff I saw a little bit of Sutton United against AFC Wimbledon, which was a good atmosphere, small ground, eventually a 0-0 draw, so not an most entertaining game. But it was kind of strange, though, because it was actually played on an artificial surface, so that kind of ruins the occasion slightly. Some of the other FA Cup observations I had, it was nice to see actually Keith Costigan there with Fox Sports. He was doing pre-match interviews live from Deepdale for the Preston against Arsenal match, and we had he had a pre-match interview with Kevin Kilbane, which was really really good, and I thought it was nice to see Keith at the match commentating, etc. Well, actually providing his analysis. On the panel, in the studio, we had Ian Joy, as aforementioned, as well as Warren Barton, Brad Friedel, Alexi Lalas. The analysis was nothing illuminating. It was kind of the average stuff that you would expect to hear on any podcast or radio show. You would think that they would add something enlightening or something intriguing or interesting, but it was kind of just the same old stuff. Nothing too much to say there, too. But the one thing I did watch, Kartik, that was a little bit different was actually... So I didn't get to watch all of the games. And actually, I wrote a piece. I'm not sure if you had a chance to read it, but I wrote a piece about the FA Cup. And I was just talking about how the FA Cup coverage, TV coverage, is still stuck in the radio age, which basically what the kind of the premise of the story was is that you look at most of the matches played over the weekends, like, what, 32 matches, I think it was, 25 of them are played on the Saturday. So the majority are played on the Saturday. And out of those 25, I think 21 all kick off at the same time, which is 10 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock UK time. And so if you want to kind of follow, first of all, if you want to watch some of those matches, so like an Everton against Leicester is one example. That match was not available anywhere in the world live. You weren't able to watch it. And there was a bunch of other matches too. Like there's a Newcastle against Birmingham. I mean, you go down the long list. There's only a few that they can actually show. well, they could show more. And that was kind of about the article I was talking about, is the way the FA Cup is structured from a TV perspective, but also from a scheduling perspective. It doesn't make it a very attractive TV property because there is no whip-around coverage show. There's no multi-match 90 or Champions League goal show type of thing or goal rush. There isn't that available yet. Hopefully in the future there would be. But at the end of the day, you're able to get and see some of the goals, maybe halftime, but not much. And I don't think there was kind of a wraparound kind of a review show from Fox Soccer in terms of the FA Cup. But what I did watch was on BBC One on Saturday night. They had a FA Cup highlight show, and that one went through every single game and showed every single goal. So obviously there's cameras at every stadium, but I mean, for a typical Premier League match, you might have 32 cameras. For an FA Cup match, you might have, say, three or four. There are just, if that, just to pick up, just to be able to shoot the goal highlights. And actually, to me, Kartik, it was a little bit of a chore to go through. It wasn't a lot of really appealing, fantastic storylines from the FA Cup third round thus far. The only one to me really that was of most interest perhaps was Plymouth going to Anfield and getting that 0-0 tie. But what are your thoughts, Kartik, on the FA Cup just in general in terms of, you mean, is there a way to kind of improve this product to make it better for TV?
Yeah, I'm sure there is, but the reality of the situation is that many teams are not taking the competition seriously in the Premier League. And I have to point out in the Championship. In the Championship, there are a lot of teams that are chasing promotion that don't play their first squads. I think there's been a narrative that's developed that it's the top Premier League clubs that are snubbing this competition. It's the top six, top eight or whatever. But in reality, if you look at the squad rotation of Championship clubs, it happens there too for the clubs chasing promotion. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know how it becomes a more appealing TV property if you're going to continue to have the third round right after the festive period. I'm not quite sure how you fix the time slots, because the 3 p.m. kickoff in England is sacrosanct. And the reality is that this competition still exists for the fans and the romance of the cup. For lower division sides, not necessarily for Premier League and Championship sides, but for amateur sides, for sides that we fall in love with for a round or two, that have supporters that are accustomed to watching matches at a certain time. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can do much more with the competition. Sutton United is a great example. That's the type of club we fall in love with in the FA Cup. They would have to play generally in that 3 p.m. On a Saturday time slot. So there's some ability to move games around for television, and we've seen that, but I'm not quite sure how you make it too much more attractive. I mean, in some respects, it's a throwback, and it's important for newer fans of the game to understand this is what English football was like before the Premier League went away, and this is the type of television coverage and exposure you got to it before the Premier became this global phenomenon. It's kind of nice in a way, yeah. To be from that perspective.
That's a great point. And that kind of, in some ways, that article I wrote, which is still on worldsoccertalk.com, talks about kind of basically that, you know, I mean, basically the FA Cup TV coverage is stuck in a different decade. It's not in, you know, in the 2010s, whatever. It's back in like the 1990s, it seems, just because there's so few games televised. The coverage, usually there's the single commentator, there isn't the two commentators, but overall it's not a very well televised broadcast. Now on radio, Kartik, I mean, to me the FA Cup is made for radio. You can tune into, I mean, BBC Five Live or Talk Sports, and you mean you got radio kind of basically broadcasters jumping from ground to ground to ground across England and Wales, kind of telling you, okay, hey, this is what's happening at this small ground, this is who scored here. And from a radio perspective, it's captivating. It's actually, to me, it's better to experience the FA Cup through radio than it is through television. But how, what does that say? I mean, how few of us really unless you live in the UK or live in a big city, how few of us really kind of live our lives through radio anymore. One thing that could happen, Kartik, perhaps, is seeding. Because even for the fourth round of the FA Cup, the draw that they made, almost all of the teams, the kind of the lower league teams, most of them are playing away. So there's very few glamour ties where you can see, okay, say, I don't know, Sutton United, they have to beat Wimbledon, but Sutton United at home against Manchester United or something like that. Most of it is kind of, you mean, I don't know, whoever it may be, if it's Liverpool, if they beat Plymouth, Liverpool will play home against, I can't even remember which team it was, but it's not a glamour tie that it could be. But it's luck of the draw, and that's the way it's set up right now. But definitely changes are needed, I believe. Kartik, one more thing before we go on to the next segment, and that's the League Cup, EFL Cup. I watched both of the games this week on BN Sports, and a lot underwhelmed. I was expecting, given what BN Sports has done in previous rounds of this tournament, that they would be having kind of analysis and kind of maybe 30 minutes with Kevin Egan and Gary Bailey and, you mean, kind of George Metellus and kind of maybe Kay Murray too, and maybe Terry Lee. I kind of gave a lot of analysis, and it was kind of really mailed in. I think George Metellus, I think, was on both of them, but it was kind of just a, actually, no, he was on one on Tuesday, and I think it was Andres. On Wednesday. But it was kind of just a very matter of fact, here's what the game is, a couple of minutes of team lineups and ready for the match. I guess in some ways, those too. I mean, you've got Copa del Rey happening at the same time, and you've got Copa del Rey and Coupe de France actually happening too on BN Sports. So maybe they were just stretched, or maybe some of the talent are still on vacation, perhaps. Who knows? Okay, Kartik, let's move on to the next segment. And the next segment is TV streaming news. And Kartik, unfortunately, we're going to start off with some sad news, and that is that Graham Taylor, who was the England manager profiled in the Fly on the Wall documentary, Do I Not Like That, has died today, age 72. And while he was a legend at Watford, helping them rise to the First Division and discovering John Barnes, he's remembered, unfortunately, by many for his failure in trying to get England to qualify for World Cup 1994, and that film focuses on that failed qualifying attempt. Kartik, what are some of your memories of Graham Taylor?
I think of him more as the Watford manager, the guy that kind of revolutionized that intake of youth players, Watford Academy, Barnes, other folks, at the height of Watford's existence. And I was thinking about that recently with the Behind the Badge documentary that NBC Sports and Gary Lineker did on Watford. I think of him more about that, than, but of course the English press and England and fans around England are obsessed with the England national team. So unfortunately, that was an unfortunate blot on his career that has come to define him.
Yeah, unfortunately, one of the striking images that I have in my head of him is the cover. I think it was The Sun that had it. Basically, it was kind of a turnip head. And it had a big picture of a turnip, and it had kind of Graham Taylor's face superimposed on that. And it was kind of just talking about the failure of England kind of crashing out of qualifying. And it was 93, I think that would have been probably, or late 93. And I remember being in England on vacation for a few weeks there. And it was kind of a sad time, actually. I think if you look back at that team, it wasn't the greatest of England teams anyway. And I think he did the best with what he had. He probably could have done a better job. But really, kind of that Watford story in terms of him, I mean, Elton John as the chairman, and kind of that rise in the late 70s and just taking them up to that First Division was an incredible story for such a small club at that time. And then going on in managing, I think he managed at Wolves and also I think Aston Villa. But at the end of the day, from a TV kind of TV or radio or streaming perspective, I often remember him as just doing a lot of radio commentaries for BBC Five Live, and from what I've heard and everything I've read about him too, that everyone said that he was just a gentleman. He was a nice guy, made time for everyone, and it's definitely a shame to see him that he's passed away. Kartik, any other news from TV streaming land?
Yeah, so CBS is going to be on Hulu's live streaming platform. That includes CBS Sports Network, college soccer, NASL. Not much more in the way of soccer there, but they will be on Hulu's live streaming platform, which is good news for the millions and millions and millions of Hulu subscribers in this country.
Yeah, and Hulu will be then, once they launch this new live streaming platform, which is supposed to be called Hulu. I mean, they're not going to change the name at all. They're just going to kind of add this component in terms of being able to watch programming from CBS, Fox. We'll have to wait and see about NBC and some of the others, but it'll be another opportunity to kind of have your Sling TV versus PlayStation View versus DirecTV Now versus Fubo versus Hulu. So just another competitor, which hopefully should bring down the pricing and make it more competitive and hopefully a better product for us at the end of the day. Kartik, with the CBS Sports Network offhand, do you know if that deal with NASL was it just for last season, or is that going to continue?
Well, last season, but perhaps it continues this season. We'll see. I mean, there's a lot the NASL has to sort out. And USL is on ESPN, so ESPN3 and ESPN News and ESPN2, so they will not be on CBS Sports Network. So that means some of the teams you saw on CBS Sports Network that were NASL teams last year and moved to USL, Ottawa and Tampa Bay being those two teams, are now on the ESPN family of networks.
Ah, okay. And on to next news, and that's Fox Sports. Fox Sports this week had seminars in a mountain retreat, and they're getting ready for the 2017 Confederations Cup this summer, as well as the 2018 FIFA World Cup. And all of their talent and production crews were there, and they were led by David Neal, who's their executive producer, to begin preparations for all of their FIFA coverage, as well as Major League Soccer, Bundesliga, etc. So it's an opportunity to kind of get everyone on board, probably talk to them about each of the cities that the World Cup is going to be in Russia, some of the challenges, I'm sure, and as well as how this whole thing is going to come together in terms of it's just a huge operation, and it's good to see that they're working ahead. It'll be interesting to see too what talent they bring in. I've heard some rumblings about Fox already basically kind of pinning down some big talent commentators to be doing the World Cup coverage. So as I get more information about that, I'll be sure to report that on worldsoccertalk.com. One of the interesting developments that came out of this retreat meetings that they've had this week is that Fox Sports executives have stated that we have two home teams, USA and Mexico. And that's a departure, to me it is, at least, Kartik, for Fox, given their rah-rah support for the U.S. national team. And yes, they have covered Mexico games in the past before, and I think probably adding Fernando Fiore as well as Hercules Gomez is definitely kind of helping out on the kind of the bilinguals or the Hispanic side of things. But what are your thoughts, Kartik, on them kind of going in and trying to win over the Mexican audience on the English language side?
Well, first off, I don't think it's new, and it doesn't really surprise me, because going back to the 2013 World Cup when they had Francisco X. Rivera on the telecast, and that was the first Gold Cup they had shown on a network, a soccer channel. There was a concerted attempt to tell inside of the story to the Gold. Now, it was only a Mexican story and an American side of the story starting in 2013. It's doing that. I think what we found from empirical data is that there were a lot of English language dominant Mexican households that perhaps Fox feels they can target, and they can target those away from now it'll be Telemundo, NBC Universal's Spanish language networks that have the World Cup. with Univision, the network that has a traditional hold on Mexican-American families in the United States, losing the World Cup rights. So I think it's a smart strategic play. Will they be successful? I'm not sure. I would be pessimistic about that, but good on them for trying, because it certainly is something that is there potentially demographically for them to pick up an audience, and then that would take World Cup ratings on Fox probably past where they were on ESPN and ABC, quite honestly. If they can get those Spanish language, those people who are English language dominant households have been watching Spanish language broadcasts on Univision of previous World Cups to switch. I will throw a little bit of cold water on this and saying I know many English language fans who say they're going to watch the World Cup on another network, presumably on Telemundo, because of their dislike of Fox. But I think that that's just a small niche soccer snob audience mm-hmm. that they care about anyway.
Right. One of the challenges I think Fox will face, though, in terms of TV ratings, is the kickoff times. With it being in Russia, I believe most of the games are going to kind of be early morning kind of and late morning. So there's not going to be like with Brazil, where we had games kind of in the afternoon and sometimes going into the evening. So that's going to be a big challenge for them, as well as the size of the country. But yeah, it will be interesting to see whether they see that Telemundo perhaps is an easier target to kind of cherry pick and be able to win some of those audience over versus the Univision.
Yeah, I think that has something to do with it, honestly. Mm-hmm.
And in Kartik, north of the border, we had some news this week.
Yeah, and this comes off of MLS having a stunning, particularly consider how poorly MLS does on American television, a stunning impact on television ratings in Canada to the point where I can't even tell you what the share was. They might have gotten a 10 share, an 8 or 10 share for the two legs of the Toronto-Montreal playoff series. So they've got a new partnership with TSN, which is the kind of sports network of record in Canada, and sports. And this is going to be, I think, a real watershed moment for MLS, because it gives them, I think, the sort of blueprint and footprint in Canada that they've always wanted on United States television. So let's see how well it works in Canada, if maybe even the production quality and production values and bumper shows that come with this can be translated to an American audience in the future.
Absolutely. Now on to the Premier League. This weekend's Manchester United against Liverpool match on NBC Sports, which is going to be Sunday, I think 11 o'clock Eastern on NBCSN. It's going to feature a pitchside studio, which, Kartik, I know you and I love, with Arlo White and Danny Higginbotham and Graham Lasso. So interesting that they're adding Danny Higginbotham to this one rather than Lee Dixon. Maybe Lee is busy that particular day. But I don't know. Danny Higginbotham's, to me, I'm a big fan of his work. And maybe this is an opportunity to try to kind of bring him in more into the fold and maybe have him on a more regular basis. That would be great. But the interesting thing, Kartik, is we haven't heard much from Jeff Cameron, Tim Howard, kind of those. They haven't done much this year so far, NBC, as far as kind of pulling them in. Of course, Tim Howard in MLS, but you would think that he'd be available. Maybe not. He's not in England anymore, so. But even Jeff Cameron, I know he's recuperating or has an injury. He's actually in the U.S. right this second to try to get a scan on that or to see what the status is. But it is interesting that they have Danny Higginbotham there.
Yeah, I don't know that there are many Americans that they can plug in. I think that was the original intent. But Cameron has been injured and long-term injury, which has forced Mark Hughes to shuffle some of his back line. You've seen more of Bruno Martins-Indy and some of those sorts of players recently. And Tim Howard, of course, is playing in Major League Soccer now. I do think the Danny Higginbotham thing is interesting, that they're rotating him in, much as they had rotated in Phil Neville for the Spurs-Chelsea match. But Phil Neville, before he had gone to Valencia to be an assistant coach, had done a number of games for NBC, usually with Steve Bauer. when they would have two big games a weekend, and they would have Dixon and Lasso. I'm not sure if folks remember this from 2014 or 2015, that they would have Lasso and Dixon do a game with Arlo White, and there would be a secondary big game some weekends that they would kind of very quietly push Phil Neville the higher weekend or whatever and pair him with Steve Bauer. I think the Higginbotham one is interesting because I rate him quite highly too. So that's that should be pretty good. And I'm glad we're seeing that for this game. Again, we didn't see it for Manchester City, Liverpool, or Spurs, Chelsea, which were stunning. I mean, really. And but again, I think going back to a previous show, I think it was last week's show, there are operational in terms of during the festive period, and that's probably why they couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think they're stretched. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of games kind of coming thick and fast, and probably some of it is access too. But this will be interesting. I love them having the Pitchside Studios. I think it really brings you into that broadcast and it brings you into that match. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that one as well as hopefully an entertaining match. Now, Kartik, I've got two words for you, and this is something that probably has been a I don't know if it's a headache or it's been a part of your world this week, but that is provisional D2. So Kartik, what does that mean in terms of TV streaming coverage? And can we learn anything from the provisional D2 announcement this week by US Soccer?
No, I think we don't learn anything from a TV perspective other than maybe the Cosmos with the new ownership will be off of One World Sports. That's a possibility. Their new owner is someone that has Rocco Commisso, who has a background in media and is actually connected, from what I understand, with Ricardo Silva, who negotiated the NASL deals with CBS Sports Network and beIN last year. So it's possible the Cosmos will be part of whatever deals are negotiated for NASL this season. The second point on this is that I think the NASL operationally is sending rhetoric that they are going to kind of institute cost control measures. Now, if they don't institute cost control measures, then it might be as you were. But if they do, I'm not quite sure what their television production is going to look like, what their television footprint is going to look like, because they may not be creating quality enough streams and quality enough broadcast productions to put on beIN or CBS Sports Network this year. So we'll have to see on that. Now, from the USL perspective, all is well. They've got provisional D2 sanctioning. They are creating a company called USL Productions, which will bring all of their production of games and magazine-like features and video into under one roof. Teams have to pay into it. However, most of the cost has been deferred and paid for by USL, and they've invested in this high-end product. It will also produce streams that are good enough to throw games on ESPN3 and ESPN2 and ESPN local announcers. That having been said, there are a couple of teams in USL, I understand, that will be opting out of USL productions, including FC Cincinnati, breaking maybe a little news. That might have been broken somewhere else, scratching the pitch or pod that focuses on Cincinnati. But I'll mention that again. FC Cincinnati, which is a club that averaged more fans than about half of MLS last season in USL, in the third division now, it'll be a second division club, is opting out of USL productions and wants to keep their own production team, their own in-house announcers. Because what this does, what USL productions does, is it's like Premier League productions. We'll have their studio will be in Fort Lauderdale, much like TWI or Premier League Productions now. Studios in London. They will have announcers, talent vetted by that company and assigned to games from that studio. Now, FC Cincinnati has decided they want to keep a certain degree of homerism. That's within their rights, so they've opted out. But that will be what the level of what you see is. You will see general USL announcers who are assigned to various games by USL Productions, and the production, the television broadcast, everything will look the same, consistent graphics, consistent feel, much like you get with the Premier League games that you see on the world feed when NBC doesn't have their own talent at the games and doesn't superimpose their graphics. But again, they will not be local announcers. They will be USL announcers based out of Fort Lauderdale, which is why over at the Vista Studios, which is why there are clubs that want a sort of local feel, and FC Cincinnati is one of them, and they are opting out.
Okay. And last but not least, the big news of yesterday, Wednesday, was that we broke the news that Fox Sports has hired a new face for their Bundesliga coverage. Not just the Bundesliga coverage, but also a presenter that's going to be working with them for the Confederations Cup, the World Cup, and a lot of other soccer properties, I'm sure. And that person is Kate Abdo. And Kate, you may remember as she was on the 2015 Women's World Cup talent for Fox Sports, and she did the, I think there was the FIFA Women's World Cup Tonight show, I think it was, due to the nightly shows. But she's also worked with Sky Sports from, I think, 2014 to 2016. She's hosted the Ballon d'Or Awards for several years, and she comes with a wealth of experience. This is somebody that knows the game, speaks German, Spanish, French, and English fluently, and has the experience, and in some ways could be maybe Fox's basically kind of answer to Rebecca Lowe at NBC Sports. Maybe they're thinking along the same lines in terms of having a new face. But from what I understand, she'll be the new face of the Bundesliga, and then she's going to be actively involved on Fox Sports with her soccer coverage. Of course, Rob Stone and Ian Joy will still be there, busy as ever. But I think this is just an indication of, one, Fox's plans for the World Cup coverage, but two, also in terms of with the amount of soccer properties that they do have the rights to, is just trying to spread the wealth. So rather than having Rob Stone do every single broadcast of any game as well as doing other stuff, here's an opportunity to have to kind of share the wealth and have these guys kind of switch different spots and work out what's best for each of them. But good news, very good news for Fox Sports, and looking forward to seeing her more on US television. So Kartik, let's dive into TV ratings.
Yeah, so the Old Firm Derby was on New Year's Eve on FS1 before the NBC game between Manchester City. And there were 61,000 people who watched the Old Firm Derby, which is good for a Scottish game. And it was a nice thing to see that game on FS1. The New Year's Eve game between Liverpool and Man City on NBC and NBC Universo, which is Spanish language, had close to 1.4 million viewers. It is the most watched EPL game of this season so far. But again, these are tough comparisons because it was on NBC, the network. It was also a New Year's Eve game, and it was also a Saturday game at 12:30 with no competition from NFL and I think some college bowl games. Although the semifinal game between Clemson and Ohio State in college football kicked off right at the end of this game, but still good rating for that. FA Cup, some decent ratings for FS1. They had 313,000 viewers for Spurs Villa, the game I referenced earlier, and 369 for Preston versus Arsenal, which was in that 12:30 Eastern time on a Saturday time slot. On Friday, they had 137,000 for West Ham versus Manchester City, which is more than they typically for Bundesliga games in all of these same time slots on FS1. Mm-hmm. So that's important to note. So the Bundesliga doesn't get those sorts of numbers. That Friday time slot, we've seen occasionally Bundesliga numbers get up to 60 or 70,000 if Bayern is playing. Or I think there was an RB Leipzig Leverkusen game, which were Schalke, somebody on a Friday that got 60 or 70,000. But that's an interesting thing if you want to do a head-to-head comparison. And Bundesliga fans get annoyed that in latter rounds that maybe Bundesliga games get bumped to Fox Soccer Plus for FA Cup games on FS1 once the Bundesliga play later this month. I've heard those complaints in the past. Why? This is the reason. Chris, you might have some news about such. This is interesting.
Yeah, this is eye-opening. But the Sutton United against AFC Wimbledon match that was on Saturday, the FA Cup match, the 0-0 draw on FS1, had more viewers than the Manchester United against Reading match that was earlier that day, also on FS1. So it was the Sutton Wimbledon match had 6,000 more viewers, obviously helped by the 10 a.m. kickoff versus Eastern Time versus the 7:30 kickoff with Man United. But still, I mean, regardless, you would imagine that Man United, even for an early match, would get a much higher viewing number than a Sutton United against Wimbledon. What it does show, I think, in many ways, is that I think there were a lot of people on Twitter especially kind of complaining, like, why have we got Sutton against Wimbledon? Why don't we have Everton against Leicester? But it does show the magic of the FA Cup in terms of that people are interested in seeing these non-league teams oftentimes and lower league teams and enjoying those types of matches and atmospheres that you typically don't get. I will say, though, Kartik, though, we talked about this last week, I thought that Fox did a really poor job of promoting the FA Cup coverage. Now, if you watch FS1 daily and watch all of their kind of talking head shows, none of them are soccer related, but if you do watch those, then you would have seen FA Cup promos. Now, if you, like me, don't watch FS1 during the week, that you only turn on to FS1 or FS2 whenever there's soccer on, you would have had absolutely zero idea that Fox was actually showing the FA Cup this go-around, unless you went to worldsoccertalk.com and you were reading the stories and looking at the schedules. Just a couple of different examples, Kartik, on my travel soccer team, kind of where I get to know the parents just as well as the kids, there's two supporters on there, and they're very casual fans. So one's a Tottenham Hotspur fan, and one's a Manchester United fan. And they're both very casual. They do watch, they do support those teams. They do watch the games, but they don't watch every game, and they just kind of, they like to have a team, and that's their team. Both of these guys had no idea that Man United had a game on Fox this weekend from the FA Cup, and also Spurs had a game. Both of them said to me on separate occasions, I looked at the schedule, which I'm guessing they're looking on the mobile phone, like ESPN FC or something, looking at the schedule. Yeah, how come Man United has a break for a week or 10 days before they play the next game? Same thing too with a Spurs fan. A Spurs fan was like, "Yeah, I'm looking at the schedule, and it's just there's nothing going on this weekend." Both of them had absolutely no idea that Fox FS1 had these games on, and then I told them about it, and they said, "Oh, okay, great. I'm gonna have to set my timer and watch it." But just an indication, I think, from Fox's perspective, sometimes they think that people naturally know that the games are on Fox, but that isn't always the case.
Correct. And there's always some mystery as to what games Fox is showing, I think, for the general audience also. I mean, NBC, not only do you know that there are Premier League games, but they promote the particular game they have.
Yep.
If a big one or involves one of those teams pretty heavily.
Yeah, and this past weekend, too, I didn't see it personally, but I heard about it on Twitter. But on the NFL playoffs, they had, on NBC, they were promoting, I think, the Man United against Liverpool match. And somebody had posted on Twitter asking me, like, well, do you think Fox is going to do the same thing for the Bundesliga? And I said, probably not, definitely not. And as far as I know, they did not. So those types of things, you know, I mean, simple things, really. I mean, yes.
But the Bundesliga doesn't resume for a couple of weeks, so maybe they will as they get deeper into the playoffs.
Maybe. I doubt it. I mean, if I had all this time the last couple of years to do it, they don't really seem to do it, though, on the other broadcasts. We had Bob Costas, right, talking about the Premier League, I think, during the Olympics, and kind of talking about that for a few minutes and stuff like that. I mean, that's precious airtime.
Kind of corresponds, though, with, look, the Premier League is a natural fit for NBC, and we've said this now for the 4 years it's been on NBC, because there's a focus on international sports there. They've got Formula One racing, subsequently have picked up
rugby
and some cricket as well. And Tour de France they've had now, that predates them having the Premier League. And now they've gotten the Open Championship, which was previously on ESPN and ABC. So they have built a portfolio built around a lot of international properties. And I have to say a lot of British and Australian international properties fitting that kind of Anglophone preference or Anglosphere preference. So the Premier League fits naturally with the sports division and what they promote and what they broadcast. With Fox, it just doesn't. I mean, the Bundesliga and other international soccer properties don't fit with the kind of culture at Fox Sports, which is Major League Baseball and the NFL, and they do have college basketball now. Rob Stone was actually in college basketball over the weekend for them, Big East basketball, but generally have not had college basketball in the past. They've had college football for a while, and that's a kind of a whole different kind of sphere. There's a lot more crossover for American soccer fans with hockey, which also is on NBC, sorry. Hockey, college basketball, and the NBA. I've noticed that the crossover is much greater with those sports than with NFL, Major League Baseball, and NASCAR, and college football. So that's something to note.
That's a good point. I mean, in some ways, the way that soccer is treated at Fox, it's almost like in isolation. It's almost like a completely separate division that has nothing to do with kind of the normal kind of tried and true NFL, NBA, NASCAR coverage that we're used to seeing. Obviously, that's not the case, but that from the viewer's perspective, from my perspective, that's the way it feels sometimes. All right, Kartik, let's see what we got next. Okay, so we've got listener mailbag, Kartik. And actually, I'm going to run through these three comments from Twitter and give you some of my opinion about this one and definitely get to hear your opinion. But basically, what we did the last episode is we talked about Men in Blazers a little bit, and we talked about Roger Bennett, and we talked about, I think you asked the question, Kartik. You said, like, hey, let us know if Men in Blazers has influenced you as far as kind of being a gateway drug into watching soccer and getting into soccer. Well, we got three comments from people. This first is from David Arnold from Twitter, and he says, I enjoy your podcast. Recently became obsessed with soccer since 2014. During the last two summer breaks, I went through all of the Men in Blazers previous podcasts. Men in Blazers was my gateway. I can see it wearing on the crowds that grew up with soccer a little bit. But for myself, Men in Blazers introduces context. Men in Blazers gave me background, names I never knew, allowed me to dig deeper in a lot of topics I would have otherwise not have known. Men in Blazers isn't my number one anymore, but I still listen to new episodes. Total Soccer Show, The Goldmouth Pod, and Guardian Sport are my must-listens. Now, the second one is from Amy DeMalley, also through Twitter, and she says, I listen to a lot of soccer pods, and I think what people like about Men in Blazers is that soccer doesn't need to be serious all the time. There is so much more to the sport, at least for me, than tactics, formations, etc. It's nice to have a silly break and is more of a casual conversation among friends. When I talk about the games with my friends, we talk about the fun and random things. Unfortunately, in the U.S., there are only so many options. The same voices, opinions on ESPN FC and NBC. Men in Blazers is just a nice, fun break. And lastly, as far as kind of Men in Blazers comments, from Blake Vajgert, also on Twitter too, and he says, just listening to the pod, yes, Men in Blazers was my gateway drug into soccer. Coverage of Euros 2012 was my fix. Now, Kartik, before I have you add your comments to this one too, I do want to mention that when I was talking about Men in Blazers and kind of their influence or lack of influence, I was talking about television. So on the podcast, I have no issue with, but in terms of the TV side, I was kind of questioning whether or not they had much of an influence on that side of things. It's definitely entertaining if you're into that, but all three comments were kind of people saying, like, yes, the podcast, yes. But none of the comments here or none of the feedback we received was regarding the television show. Kartik, what's your thoughts on all of this?
Maybe the television show isn't driving people to your league coverage, and we know the ratings are pretty low. However, it appears like, based on these comments, based on talk to in the interim since the last show, that either their fandom was created by listening to the Men in Blazers radio program or was intensified by listening to the radio program. So and this is all obviously all very unscientific, and we all have our opinions about the actual show itself, but it seems like a gateway drug, whichever comments that you just read, but it certainly seems like that was the case for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I need to do at some point, or have one of my writers do in the coming weeks, is take a look at the TV numbers for Men in Blazers and see if that has increased, decreased, whatever it may be. And I know they've been doing a bunch of live shows recently, kind of at the end of usually the Monday games, sometimes the Sunday games. And I think that's a good move in terms of trying to make it feel more like the podcast, make it feel more kind of free-flowing rather than scripted. Again, personally, I'm not a fan, but I can see how people would be. But I want to look at those TV numbers to see kind of how much of an impact they're having, if at all. On the podcast side, yeah, I completely agree. On the podcast side, I think they, in some ways, have changed the whole soccer podcast side of things, where it is a little bit more lighter, more fun, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just on the TV side, I don't know, I've just been really disappointed and just feel that it's just the same old shtick. Okay, Karthik, let's move on to the next question or comments, and this is in the listener mailbag from email, and his name is Clinton Cam, and he says, "Hey, Karthik and Chris, with the recent episode being about play-by-play and color commentators, I want to ask you these three questions." And Karthik, I'm going to ask each question, and I'll have you answer each one, because I have no clue. So hopefully you can help me here, too. Okay, question number one from Clinton is, says, "What commentator from another sport would you consider doing well in soccer for play-by-play commentating? For example, I would consider Jim Hewson from Hockey Night in Canada doing well in soccer play-by-play commentary because of his recognizable catchphrases and his direct style of hockey play-by-play commentary."
Yeah, maybe. I think he actually, he's much more, and again, calling hockey is a little bit different than calling these American sports. You don't have as many breaks and stoppages and you have constant action. He's very kind of direct in his commentary style.
Okay, and then the second question is, what commentator from another sport would you not recommend doing well for soccer commentary? He says, for example, can you imagine Marv Albert using his famous catchphrases such as "gorgeous move" every time Messi or Ronaldo dribbles through a defender? I would add, Karthik, from my personal point of view, Gus Johnson's probably an example of a commentator that from another sport that I would not recommend it doing for soccer commentary. Been there, done that, and I wasn't a big fan. But from your perspective, Karthik, anyone that kind of comes to mind as far as that it wouldn't be a good fit for soccer?
Yeah, I think Joe Buck talks too much and is interjecting commentary as well. And then I think Jim Nance is a guy that has called football, a lot of college basketball, and golf. And in golf, you're always kind of filling dead time. I'm not quite sure he would do that well. That having been said, I mean, well, again, maybe as a studio host, some of these guys would be okay. That having been said, there was a lot of skepticism about Chris Fowler and Mike Tirico. Chris Fowler is actually a soccer fan, so there probably shouldn't have been much skepticism about him. But when the ESPN brought them into soccer, and both did quite well, and Tirico, in fact, had an extended run until the end of his ESPN tenure doing various soccer-related broadcasts, including his sign-off on ESPN was on a soccer broadcast. So maybe studio these guys work, but they won't work as commentators.
Yeah, Tirico is great, and he was in my top 10 of presenters for soccer coverage that we recently did. And then the third and final question for Clinton is, he says, "I don't know if it's me or not, but I notice when it comes to soccer, the commentators tend to be more descriptive than other sports commentators. Other sports like baseball, ice hockey, or basketball tend to be using more of a direct language than in soccer. Would putting a commentator from a different sport overall make the soccer experience more watchable, since sometimes they could sometimes add a different dimension of excitement during a game?"
Not for me, but maybe for other people. I mean, again, I don't know what kind of announcer you need in the American audience to get American sports fans. Perhaps you need a Joe Buck type guy. Maybe John Strong doesn't cut it with his innate knowledge of the sport and his descriptive commentary. Maybe you need someone who's more cliché-ish, like a Joe Buck. I don't know. I prefer John Strong. That's why maybe I'm the wrong person to ask. But maybe different for most American sports fans.
yeah, different strokes for different folks, really. I mean, one of the things he talks about soccer commentators being more descriptive than other sports, I think part of that is that a lot of the soccer commentators have a background in radio. Derek Ray, Martin Tyler, I mean, you go down the list, a lot of them started off in radio, so you have to be more descriptive on radio and kind of paint a picture of what you're seeing, and that translates well to TV coverage, but oftentimes perhaps is a little bit more descriptive. Arlo White is somebody else too that started off in radio, is extremely
John Fong did radio for the Portland Timbers,
yep,
when they were else. So there are a lot of examples of that, and I think that's a good point. Now I think what we've seen with television is that you have an era now of people who are just calling games that came up through TV. Now, previously, Vern Lundquist just retired. He did SEC football on CBS at the end of his career. But he had come up through radio doing Dallas Cowboy games before Brad Sham did. And Brad Sham did a lot of soccer for FC Dallas through the years also. And Lundquist's commentary style was very different than and he actually did the old NASL on CBS back in the, or ABC back in the day. But Lundquist's commentary style was much more descriptive than the younger people who had been brought in to do college football games after him. And he just retired, as I said, for that SEC championship game, Florida-Alabama game last month. But he had a different commentary style because he came through radio. And that's a very good point, Chris. I hadn't thought of that. But that even applies to American sports.
And the last question from the listener mailbag is from Scott from McAllen, Texas. And he says, I know the problem is a number of things with the poor MLS TV viewership, but I will point out one problem I have here in South Texas that could act as a small example. I'm sure it can be applied elsewhere. He says that here in McAllen, it's considered Houston Dynamo country. They have Los Toros here. They have two academies here as well. One academy through Los Toros and the Dynamo Academy through the McAllen Youth Soccer Association. They also support the MYSA Rec League as well. Their shield is on my son's jersey, as well as the jerseys in my MYSA. They also put out youth training camps here as well. We literally see the Dynamo shield everywhere down here when it comes to soccer. They have plenty of promotion, yet you can't watch Dynamo games here on television. They do their regular season regional games through Comcast, and down here is Time Warner. It doesn't do any good to get MLS direct kick because you're blacked out when it's an in-market team, and Houston is 7 hours away, and going to a game is difficult. I want to support and watch the Dynamo, but can only watch if they happen to be shown on Fox, ESPN, or Unimas. He says, I find it strange that if I choose to, I can literally watch every single Liga MX game through a season, but rarely have ability to watch the game, watch the team that supports the community. Maybe TV contracts is a contributor to less viewers. Would a major network doing regional coverage be a better remedy? Kartik, your thoughts on this?
Well, Scott's just kind of paraphrasing what we hear, a lot of critiques of MLS's TV contracts and the coverage that has prevented the league from really emerging as a national league, right? It's in niche markets and popular in areas, right? I think this is all very, very interesting. His theories behind this, but quite sure there is going to be a remedy before 20, the new television contract. In fact, I think there won't be.
Okay, so let's dive into the featured topic of the week. And Kartik, our featured topic of the week this week is the impact of FIFA World Cup having 48 teams as of 2026. And what that impact will be on TV networks and the viewing experience. Now, there's been plenty of thoughts and opinions shared across social media and across the web in regards to what people think from just a different perspective, like whether it's a national perspective, etc. But very little from the TV perspective. Kartik, what are some of your initial thoughts about kind of those changes and whether they may be positive or negative?
I think they're very negative. I think it's going to water down the product. It gives more games for television networks, but it's going to water down the product. It's going to give television networks less attractive games to market. It's going to give viewers I think, less of a hook to be obsessed with the tournament for a month, a casual viewer. So, I mean, if they're watching Uzbekistan versus Trinidad and Tobago, no offense to those countries, but in a group stage match, I think it's it doesn't quite have the hook that some of the group stages do under the current 32-team format or did under the 24-team, 16-team format in the past. Also, I just don't like the idea of more games or pair the body of players because that affects the European club game and those Belgian-driven leagues. Also, and I think this is important to point out, I think the group stage gets completely messed up by three-team groups and the possibility of penalty shootouts and completely unworthy teams getting into the knockout stages because they've won two penalty shootouts, let's say, and they played twice. And they've advanced because of that, thus watering down the knockout stages for television. I know why it's being done. I think it's been done for political reasons and to pay back voters who voted for Gianni Infantino a year ago in the FIFA election, or 11 months ago. But I don't think it's good for football. I don't think it's good for television. I don't think it's good, period.
Yeah, Kartik, I mean, just alluding to the penalty kick shootouts there, just for those listeners who may not be aware. So the concept from Infantino, the FIFA president, is that there will be no draws in matches. So if the games end in a draw, there'll be a penalty shootout just to ensure that there is a winner, especially in a group of three. You have several groups of three that it's going to be tight. So you need to figure out who's going to win these games. Otherwise, you could have all draws and it could get kind of pretty mindless. But to me, Kartik, this whole thing is quantity, not quality. I mean, and necessarily, quantity doesn't necessarily mean it is better in the end. You mean is it better to have a 32 team or a 16 team tournament with the best teams in the world? My concern is burnout. So traditionally, I mean, a lot of soccer fans will try to watch every game or the majority of games. The concern I have is burnout. So you have all of these group stage matches with these each group having three teams, and you have about 16 more games. You'll have 16 more games in 2026 than you would have, say, in this the most recent World Cup. And it could lead to burnout. So by the time you get to kind of the quarterfinal stage, or maybe the second round stage, you could have where TV viewers are kind of, oh, this is going on forever, or seems to go on forever. If you're watching a lot of games, and especially the quality of them, you have to kind of wonder whether these games will be of a quality that we want to watch and keep on watching. At the end of the day, this means approximately $1 billion more in revenue for FIFA because of these changes. So I think pretty much most of us will agree that these changes are being done for monetary reasons, and like you said to Kartik, political favors, to kind of, whether it's Africa or Asia, to say, hey, thank you for voting for me, Infantino, to become president. Here's a way for me to kind of give back to you, to kind of help you guys out. And we're going to be able to have more teams from Africa, Asia, et cetera, from around the world competing in this type of tournament. From a TV perspective, so it means that Fox will get more games. They have the rights to the 2026 World Cup, as well as 22 and 18. Interestingly enough, for those who don't know, so Fox had the rights to the 2018 and 22 World Cups. Then once they found out for the 22 World Cup in Qatar that the games would be played in the wintertime rather than the summertime, Fox threatened to sue FIFA because of that. And the reason then that basically what happened was that FIFA then gave Fox the 2026 rights to that at no extra cost, kind of just as a favor to say, hey, here's the 2026 World Cup rights. That lawsuit, that's going to drop that. And then they reached agreement there. So Fox is already getting the 2026 World Cup for free, essentially. And now they're getting 16 more games. So they're looking at it probably thinking, like, this is jackpot. We're going to get bigger TV ratings. We're going to get more matches. We're going to get 16 more countries. Well, not 16 more countries, but a lot more countries participating in this tournament than they would normally. So it's probably they're seeing the dollar signs in all of this. It's sad though to Carter because I think it is going to diminish and dilute the quality of the tournament. The other thing, Kartik, is match fixing. What are your thoughts? Could this increase the chances of match fixing happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you've got a situation now where you've got countries that may not that qualify that aren't worthy that necessarily of this sort of competition, who might have players that play in domestic leagues where their paychecks come late. FIFA Pro is estimated in the continent of South America, in some countries like Brazil, paychecks come over half the time late. The players where they might be willing to throw games because there'll be a lot of money that fixtures come and approach them with. If let's say Jordan, and the Jordanian players haven't been paid in a while at their club sides, and the fixtures have a 4-0 scoreline for Germany, or have something along the lines that a Jordanian player will get sent off in the first 30 minutes. Those sorts of bets, it could in fact be very tempting to match fixers.
Plus, I think it's one of those things that going into the tournament, if Infantino's concept of having these penalty kicks to resolve games that end in a draw does go into effect, basically kind of bookies knowing going into this tournament, players not going into this tournament know that maybe the number of matches that will have penalty kicks to decide who goes through to the next stage or who wins that game. It could be, I don't know, say a dozen games that will be resolved by penalty kicks. So as far as kind of the match fixes, knowing ahead of time, I mean, with a penalty kick, that's something that's, to me at least, a lot easier to kind of fix than, say, a result in the game. I mean, in a penalty, you could try to convince a couple of players to kind of miss their penalties, then all of a sudden kind of a shock result happens.
Yeah, that's another one, right? That's another possibility. I mean, we could have a whole show on match fixing and the possibilities that will open up because of this expansion of the World Cup, or just in general in World Cup competitions, and FIFA's unwillingness to tackle this, FIFA's really kind of ignorance to the situation, or perhaps, you know, given FIFA's history, perhaps some of the officials in FIFA are happy with the money that's flowing from gambling, and maybe some of them are involved in it, for all I know. I mean, I wouldn't rule anything out at this point, because match fixing, I mean, I remember when Declan Hill first wrote his book, The Fix, 8 or 9 years ago. I thought it was a real alarmist book. Talked to him, began to change my mind, then observed some things, then worked in the game, the second division level in the United States, observed some things, and just have come to the point of view now that match fixing is much more prevalent than we think it is, and that the possibilities for match are so endless that if regulatory bodies aren't doing something about it, there's probably a reason for it.
Right. And Kartik, I'm being sarcastic here, but the voice of reason, Alexi Lalas, who to me is like the company man. I mean, if you want to ever have somebody to give you the company response, Alexi's the guy. And he says on Twitter, in terms of this whole 48 teams, he says, I like it. He says, it makes World Cup 2026 immediately unique, historic, and more interesting. Different format, different strategy, different experience. What do you think about that, Kartik?
There is some truth to that. I mean, I think there's a possibility that we might see something appealing in the very first World Cup, because there's this novelty factor of certain countries qualifying for the first time and an expanded field. And we saw that with the Euros in 2016, although truth be told, Iceland and Northern Ireland would have qualified regardless in the old 16-team field. Albania would not have, so that was a nice story. But there'll be some nice stories like Albania, and Albania played pretty well in the Euros. That will wear off by 2030. Mm-hmm. And what have we done to this world, to this competition? It's a watered-down, cheapened competition with the possibility of match-fixing and all these unappealing television games and its ramifications on European clubs. So, yeah, I think Lawless's analysis fits for the 2026 version, which, heck, might be in the United States. So maybe that's what he's thinking of.
But, exactly. Yeah, it's a little bit self-serving, I think. I think he's thinking, okay, right, like 2026, it's probably going to be in North America. Probably most of the games will be in the US. He's going to be kind of on a pedestal, and he's also going to be probably working with Fox still, giving coverage. So he has to be kind of positive, I think. Somebody who was negative, surprisingly to a certain extent, was Grant Wall, kind of posting on Twitter saying that, this is kind of almost not the end, but this is a kind of a sad day with the World Cup, and kind of this is kind of the point where maybe it's going to become less meaningful. I replied back to him to say, actually, to me, it was December 2nd, 2010, that was the World Cup became less meaningful when Qatar won the vote. So, that's the other thing, too. You got 2022 in this, all of this. So 2022 could be a disaster on a whole bunch of different levels.
Russia is controversial enough. 2022 is Qatar. That makes it more controversial. In 2026, you have this expanded World Cup. I mean, they really... So many people said this 2014 in Brazil was the last genuine World Cup. And my thinking was, okay, that's true. We're saying that now with a romantic view of things. And also in the United States, it was the last World Cup on ESPN before this Fox contract began, which everybody's fearful of. But that's a whole aside. But then I thought, yeah, we'll all adjust to the new reality. But now I'm beginning to think that the competition's going to be so far gone.
Yeah.
Romanticizing about the 2002 and 2014 World Cups, and maybe the efficiency of 2006, even if it wasn't a great World Cup on the pitch, forever now.
Yeah, plus you got Euro 2020 that's going to be played throughout Europe with the final at Wembley, but then also I think like six or eight countries been involved in terms of these matches happening all across Europe. Politically, and as far as kind of the terrorist side of things, that's going to be a nightmare to kind of for security. But on the idea perspective, I like that idea in terms of just kind of sharing it around these different countries that are like. But they're not increasing the number of teams to 48. You mean, and the World Cup by 2026, maybe it's not going to be that meaningful anymore. Maybe that the 2022 is going to basically make us so upset that maybe many people will not tune into the 2026. Even the 2018, with it being in Russia, there's a lot of question marks about that. I think it's almost like it's as each World Cup happens, there's more and more people that become disinterested for different reasons. A lot of them are ethical or political reasons. But we shall have to wait and see what happens there. Kartik, I want to thank you for joining me today. And listeners, thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. And don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And be sure also to send us your feedback or questions so we can read them out on air. You can reach us at email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. On Twitter, it is WSoccerTalk. And last but not least, on Facebook, it is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. Kartik, over to you.
Enjoy your football.